We'll call our next case 61409, Miller versus Surety Life Insurance Company. Mr. Auerbach, you're appearing for the appellant. You ready to proceed?
Your Honor.
You may proceed.
Thank you.
Good morning, Justices. I want to give you a little perspective that's in the briefs, but from my perspective...
Excuse me, Mr. Counsel, opposing counsel, seen that chart up there?
I'll give her a copy of it.
Okay, listen.
Trial was May 7th. Oh, I would like to reserve 9 minutes.
Okay.
Trial was May 17th. That's a Tuesday. I was hired on the Thursday before. So I go and look and see what's a matter of record, and I see that there's a breach of contract lawsuit, and I see that there's a foreclosure. And so when I'm preparing for trial, I'm preparing for a breach of contract with damages minus anything that's obtained at the trustee sale. However, I look at the law, NRS 40.453, and I go, gee, that means that it's a deficiency hearing, not a trial on a breach of contract. So I look, there's an affirmative defense for Chapter 40 issues, so I think I'm good to go, and I go into the trial. There are different issues that have to be proven in each one, but basically this is an error correction case. This isn't a case of first impression. The first error is under 455. They need an applicant.
Excuse me, counsel, if you want to stand up and look at this.
I'm calling.
Okay, very well.
Look at the next page. Oh, maybe I will. I'll just follow along.
Okay.
Thank you,
Your Honor. This, under 40.455, you have to have an application for a deficiency hearing, and there's no application for a deficiency hearing anywhere in the record, especially after the trustee sale. So what's odd is at the end of the case, the judge enters a conclusion of law that this is a deficiency hearing. 40.455, notice and hearing were satisfied because the defendants, the Millers, my clients, were provided notice that they assured the plaintiff intended to seek a deficiency judgment. Well, there's no finding of fact that there was an application within 6 months. There's no finding of fact, and the reason there isn't is there is no evidence of an application for deficiency judgment. So you can stop right there and reverse Assurity's $500,000 judgment against my client and remand it and direct the court to enter judgment for my clients, because that conclusion of law is clearly erroneous with no finding of fact and no evidence to support it. But you can go further, because that's not the only error. A couple of the other big errors in this case is there's no evidence of fair market value. They didn't name an expert in this case. The third error is they never disclosed to me the trustee's deed. They, like, at the time of trial, you want to stipulate to this? I go, what is it? Trustee's deed. No. Here's their pretrial memorandum. Promissory note, guarantee, loan agreement, deed of trust. No trustee's deed. So no, I'm not going to stipulate to it. The judge lets it in because it was a recorded document. Now, it's a copy of a recorded document. I first object. This isn't authenticated.
So it wasn't certified by the county recorder?
It wasn't certified, so no authentication. Second, it's hearsay, and we know that hearsay within hearsay is inadmissible unless each part of the hearsay is admissible on its own ground. So here's the trustee's deed. Eileen Bechtel at Nevada Title says this is the date of sale. It's important to know that nobody that was at the date of sale was present to testify. Assurity's only witness, the loan officer, wasn't at the foreclosure sale. So he doesn't know what the date was. Eileen Bechtel's the only one that knows whether there was compliance with 107.080, notice of breach, notice of sale, whether it was advertised, sent out, who was the highest bidder. And Eileen Bechtel is the only one that knows the sales price of $2.5 million. So none of those statements have their own exception to the hearsay rule. But the judge took judicial notice, and the judge allowed it in, And our position is you reverse the judgment and clearly direct the lower court to enter judgment for the Millers.
Thank you. Okay, you have about 10 minutes, Mr. Rabbi. I'll have some questions. I'll wait till your next.
You can ask me now.
Well, this is your position, and we've reviewed the transcripts. Now, didn't the respondent make an effort to amend after Walder's decision came out to assert a deficiency?
No. What happened was at the start of trial, a respondent said, wait, if this is a deficiency case under Chapter 40, I want to make an oral amendment. And the judge says, you can't amend at the time of trial because you didn't even name an expert. After Walters came out, I made a motion to supplement and say, Judge, this is another reason why we should win. And what is important is trials in May, the 2 months for briefing, so that's July, the lower court didn't make a decision until July of the next year. They could have had 6 months from the time of the trustee sale to apply for a deficiency judgment or move to amend or do something, because no decision was made for 14 months after the trustee sale. Nothing was done. No attempt to amend after Walters.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Nutto.
Thank you. Allison Nutto, Sylvester and Palenik on behalf of the respondent.
Well, before we go, sure. Would you be good enough to back that, please?
I'd like to address the questions that you made as far as the amendment goes as well. At the beginning of trial, the counsel for a surety requested the court for me to amend if, in fact, the court was going to determine that this was the hearing under 4457. The court didn't say you can't amend. What the court said was, let's hear the testimony, let's see how it goes with this, and then we'll make a determination. It was then renewed at the end of trial. So to the extent that there was a necessity for some application, even following Walters, there was at that point a request for an amendment to be made. And it was within the statutory time.
Did you make a motion to amend under
it was an oral motion. It was an oral motion to the court, and I'll direct you to page 8 of the trial transcript.
We saw that. I just wondered, at any time was there a supplemental written motion under Rule 15 to amend?
Not because the court had then determined that it wasn't necessary for us to do that. And all
the court determined it after reading Walters or what?
Well, there was no determination from the court. And this was a pre-Walters case, so trial had already concluded.
Yeah, my understanding was that the Walters came down, I don't remember what date it was, but it came down a short period of time before the trial. Was that correct?
It was after the trial.
The trial was
May of 2011.
Okay.
Walters came down in October of 2011.
Okay.
So trial had already concluded.
Okay.
The court had determined amendment was not necessary. And so that was procedurally the way that it worked. But in addition, what I would also point you to, the defendant's pretrial memorandum that was filed prior to trial with respect to the notice issue. And on page 2 of the defendant's pretrial memorandum, it says, about 6 months after the lawsuit was filed against them personally, a surety got permission from the bankruptcy court to foreclose. The foreclosure sale was held in April of 2011, and the amount of the bid is unknown. A surety claims that approximately $3 million is owed on the loan, and a surety is seeking a deficiency judgment. So to argue to this court that he had no idea that this was a deficiency hearing is belied by his own pretrial memorandum, in addition to, as he mentioned, the answer that was filed, which asserted the deficiency defenses. But in compliance with 4455 and 45457, in addition to the request for amendment and the notice that was provided at calendar call, when the judge was advised by me of the pending foreclosure and her pronouncement in court that if a foreclosure concludes, an offset will be allowed.
Mm-hmm.
Defense counsel was there and participated in those hearings. But also, I would like to point the court to the language of 4430 and 44953. This When this lawsuit was filed, it was a breach of guarantee action, as Mr. Arbuck has indicated, and it was proceeding based upon a waiver of the one action rule. 4430 provides that, and I really want to read directly from the statute, except in cases where a person proceeds under subsection 2 of NRS 4495, which is a guarantee action, there may be one action for the recovery of any debt or for the enforcement of any rights secured by a mortgage or other lien upon real estate. That action must be in accordance with the provisions of 4430 to 4459. This was an action that was, as the first sentence says, a case where a person proceeds under subsection 2 of NRS 4495. So that's an action separate and apart. That's entirely consistent now with the new revisions to 44953, which encompass all the fair value.
Well, I assume your argument, counsel. I think Walter says, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that when a lender has a security interest in real property and also has a personal guarantee, they can sue on the guarantee if they don't institute foreclosure proceedings on the real property, and they have. It's a straight contract action like you started with. But if you do both, you know, if you have your cake and eat it too, so to speak, you want to sue on the guarantee and foreclose at the same time. Walter says that you have to apply for the deficiency. You made that election. You have to apply for that deficiency within 6 months of the date of the trustee's sale. Now, the fact that this trial happened before Walters came down may impact how we look at this case, but I think that's the court's interpretation of Chapter 40 and those related statutes as of the moment.
Very good, Your Honor. And again, I will point out, as you've already, that it was pre-Walters, and an application was made within 6 months by way of an oral request for amendment. But again, I'm looking at 44953, which I know this court has relied on for providing that those fair value defenses are available to a guarantor. Even in 44953, if the court looks at the plain language of that, it says, if the obligee maintains an action to foreclose, and we know in 4430 that a non-judicial foreclosure, in 44306, that a non-judicial foreclosure in 6E is excluded from an action. So we're looking under 44953. If the obligee maintains an action to foreclose, excluded by 4430, or otherwise enforce a mortgage and lien, and the indebtedness or obligation secured thereby, a guarantee is an unsecured obligation. There was no action that was maintained by my client to foreclose. It wasn't a judicial foreclosure. It was an excluded action, a non-judicial foreclosure, and no action was taken on the indebtedness or obligation secured by the real property. A guarantee action is unsecured. So even 44953 does not provide for any application of 4455 or 4457. Now, what the creditor did do in this case, pursuant to what we understood to be the law under Shields, that we're not entitled to a double recovery, went into trial, prepared, and in fact did provide evidence of the sales price, the trustee's deed upon sale, and provided testimony from Mr. Hill, who testified he had 21 years of experience in real estate, as well as familiarity with this subject property and other properties similar to it, provided his opinion of the fair market value. Now, under Unley versus Strait, this court has already determined that an owner may testify as to the fair market value of the property, if it's properly supported, which there was extensive testimony, extensive cross-examination with regard to Mr. Hill's testimony of the fair value of the property, as well as his foundation for the trustee's deed upon sale, that he received it, and the other evidentiary support that it's a publicly recorded document. Now, I will represent to this court that from that day to this, there has never been any evidence that that is not a authentic document from the Clark County Recorder's Office. And I would point the court to the Wasiak versus Cal Western case, 2012, Westlaw 1068733, for the proposition that a court can take judicial notice of facts in a publicly recorded document that are not subject to reasonable dispute. Mr. Auerbach was questioned by the judge whether or not he had any evidence or any argument that the trustee's deed upon sale was not authentic, or if he had any questions about the authenticity of the document. He never provided any argument that the contents therein were subject to reasonable dispute, and I believe that the court was completely within its discretion to allow the admission of that document. Mr. Auerbach has challenged that admission. However, this court won't disturb the district court's findings unless they're clearly erroneous, and if they're not based upon substantial evidence. This court has said that substantial evidence is that which a reasonable mind might accept as adequate to support a conclusion. So it's respectfully submitted that the admission of the trustee's deed upon sale was based upon substantial evidence, and this court should not disturb the district court.
So the argument is that the court had the discretion to take judicial notice of the trustee's sale, so on that basis it's admissible, whether it's hearsay or not.
That's correct, Your Honor, and Mr. Auerbach has provided that we were, and is correct, that we were required to provide evidence of the sales price and the fair market value in order for the judge to reach his decision. My argument to this court is that we provided both the sales price for the trustee's deed upon sale and Mr. Hill's testimony, and evidence of the fair market value through Mr. Hill's testimony as well. Mm-hmm. And with that, I'll answer any questions.
We have 5 more minutes.
That's my 5 minutes. Very good, and I appreciate that. So to summarize then, compliance with NRS 4455 and 4457, the plain language of the statutes under 4430 and 4495 is clear that an action commenced pursuant to 44952 does not have to be in accordance with 4430 or 4459, with the exception of providing those fair value defenses that case law provides and is now codified actually in 4495-4. With respect to the evidence of the sales price, summarized, the court was within its discretion to allow admission of the trustee's deed upon sale. And with respect to the fair market value, Mr. Hill's testimony, with his experience that he testified about regarding his knowledge of the market, he's also the benefit, a surety, and him as the corporate representative, is the beneficial holder of the deed of trust, and was also, in fact, the owner at the time of the foreclosure sale by virtue of the credit bid. And so he was entitled under Nevada law to testify as to the fair market value of the property. So all the elements that were required by the creditor to obtain a judgment were met in this case at the time of trial. And with respect to the attorney's fees, I'll just touch on that briefly. One of the arguments by counsel was that the judge failed to establish the reasonableness of the fees. Mr. Hill testified that it was a contractual obligation for the creditor to obtain attorney's fees. He laid the foundation for that, and also
was any analysis? Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
The word, capital word, which he used was reasonableness, and I don't remember anything as to that particular point. Not the fact that they're entitled to it. That's not the dispute. The dispute is, were they reasonable in the marketplace? What do we have?
And I believe, Your Honor, that you're correct that at the time of the trial, I don't believe that the judge reviewed the Brunzell factors as required. I think the judge took testimony, certainly understood that it was a contractual obligation, but as far as the Brunzell factors, I don't believe that the court undertook that analysis at that time. With that, if you have any other questions, I'm happy to answer.
Questions?
I guess I go back, and it was raised, it's not a big issue, but yet it is a big issue. You talk about the deed, the trustee sale deed, and so on, and the fact that we have this document that's been offered. It's not a certified copy or anything else. And in a number of contexts, we've talked about this in terms of compliance. Why should we accept this, and why should we think that the district court was proper in looking at this document and deciding, well, I'm just going to accept this? We have our formalities. Why are not the formalities appropriate in this?
And I appreciate that, Aaron, and I think what the district court held after quite an extensive amount of testimony was that she had, in fact, admitted these types of documents and admitted it was uncertified based on the indicia of reliability. There's the recorder's stamp in the corner that's required under law and has the document.
Also, it wasn't a certified copy to say this is an accurate copy of what is in the book. It's just a document that's been presented. That is the problem.
I understand you, and again, I would just, my response would be that the court reviewed that document, found it to have the indicia of reliability.
Based upon what?
Well, I believe that if I recall from the trial transcript, it was based upon the recording, her knowledge and...
She's not a recorder, she's a judge.
That's true.
She chose to be that and not that.
I understand, but I think the issue was that it was actually... It had the indicia of reliability based upon the recorder's stamp at the top of the document, and that's what I understand from
the
court.
I thought it would go with that indicia of any, particularly in this day and age, where so many forms of technology would allow us to, if you will, I'm not suggesting that anyone did, but to manufacture documents. How far do we go with that before we caution our judges that there's a rule for authenticating and we need to follow it?
I understand, and especially your concern with as far as the fact of being able to manufacture a different document. But again, I would say at some juncture, and according to the case law on which I cited, the other side also has to provide some type of substantial dispute to it. And the court asked Mr. Arbuck to provide any of that, and he could not, and to this day hasn't provided any reason he believes that didn't have the indicia of reliability that the court determined that it had.
Okay. I think we understand your position on that, and thank you very much, Mr. Arbuck.
Just to address Wozniak case that counsel was talking about, that was done on a motion to dismiss, where there's a motion and a copy of a recorded document, and at the motion to dismiss hearing, there's 15 or 20 days or 10 days to somebody to look at it and see it. I didn't see it until the day of trial. So that's the real problem with the cases that they've cited, is they at least had a chance to look at it. It's not, they don't stand for the proposition that whatever's recorded is truthful. If you owe me $100,000 and I record a document that says that, sue you for it, and then I used that recorded document as the truth of the $100,000, nobody would allow that. But let me go on to some of the other issues. That why do we need a written deficiency application? And it's really because the judges and the attorneys need to know what to expect at the time of trial.
I think, Mr. Arbuck, my concern from opposing counsel's point of view is if Walters had not come out at the time this trial was held, the judge didn't know you have to do all these things that you're pointing out. So you can't look in a crystal ball, you know, and know that. And perhaps it was proper at the time to do what was said, assuming the trustee's deed was admissible and all. So I would kind of do a little Monday morning quarterbacking with the opposing counsel here and on these issues. What's your position
on the application issue?
Yeah.
Well, the application issue is important to know what you're going forward with, because when you look at the trial transcript and you look at the findings of fact, you'll think there was a mistake. These findings of fact came from a different trial. Because at the beginning, the judge says, this has been set up by the plaintiffs as a breach, a straight breach of guarantee. The complaint was filed as such. The pretrial memo says breach of guarantee. A surety's attorney thought this was a breach of guarantee action. To the extent they're going to assert that this is Chapter 40, that's the first time I've heard of it. This is clearly a guarantee action. If the court is going to consider the protection of Chapter 40, I need to move to amend. He knew that up till the time of trial, he didn't have any application for deficiency, whether or not Walters applied. Now, don't forget, when Walters came out, October of 2011, she still had, the lower court had not entered their decision. It was still under advisement for months. So what Miller's attorney expected at the time of trial, that's me, is I go into this case, and I don't know whether it's a contract case, because the pleadings say contract, or it's a deficiency case, because the law, and subsequently Walters, but 495.3 says that if you have an action to enforce your deed of trust, you get, the guarantor gets the deficiency defenses. That's been on the books in 69. So I'm thinking this has to be a deficiency case because of this statute. Forget about Walters. How could it be a breach of contract when they've actually gone to foreclosure to enforce their deed of trust? They're done. And so I go into the case and I don't really know. So the loan officer, he's not an expert. The trial transcript shows that it was a breach of contract. When you read the trial transcript, I cross-examine the loan officer. No comps, no appraisal experience, and I move to strike his opinion. And here's what happens, which is really odd. Mr. Sylvester, the attorney for Assurity, says, counsel, that's me. Arbach's argument simply misses the mark. Mr. Hill is not proffered as an expert. Well, I'm thinking that's really good because they aren't putting forth any expert witness testimony. Why? Because Mr. Sylvester thought it was a breach of contract case. The judge denied my motion to strike. And here's what she says. The strike is denied, but it will be denied on this very specific basis. I do not believe that this witness tried to testify as to fair market value. This witness was Assurity's loan officer. So the judge is saying Assurity's only witness didn't testify as to fair market value. So the two erroneous findings of fact are number 15 and 16, that Assurity presented evidence of fair market value. The judge concluded that his testimony of 2.5 was based on the fair market value. Yet that conclusion of law is a disconnect from what she said at the beginning of trial, it's a guarantee, and what she said at the end of trial, that this guy didn't testify as to fair market value. The second one was that we didn't present any competing evidence as to fair market value. Well, here's what happens. At the end of trial, I call Mr. Miller, and the judge said, Mr. Arbach, proffer what testimony Mr. Miller is going to give, because if it's regard to fair market value, now this is at the end of the trial, if it's regard to fair market value, the court has already determined there is no testimony regarding fair market value in the record. I don't see anything to rebut, and she doesn't allow my guy to testify. I say that's what he's going to testify.
Okay, so your position is under 495 subsection 3, pre-Walters out of the mix, that there's a failure of proof here on you're arguing the burdens on Assurity and between the trustee's deed and this witness who wasn't qualified to give expert opinions on fair market value that fails. So where does that leave us?
That leaves us with the judge thinking it's a breach of guarantee action, and Mr. Sylvester thinking it's a breach of guarantee action. The findings and conclusions say it's a deficiency action, and so this is not a deficiency. This is not a deficiency evidence case. So, if the statutes and rules are mandatory, then you reverse and direct the court to enter judgment in favor of my clients. If they're just suggestions, you can just kind of follow this stuff if you want. Then you should affirm the judgment. That's what leaves you.
Assume they agree with you, but wouldn't the respondent be entitled to argue that they've moved to amend within the 6 months under Walters, and the judge would have to make that determination whether that motion should be granted so they could set forth their defenses? I mean, we don't make that call. It's the judge's call, but what's your position on that?
She did not. They only made one motion. They didn't make it after Walters. They made it at the beginning of trial, and she denied it because they didn't disclose an expert. And guess what? Discovery had closed 6 months before trial. Yeah. Total disclosure. So how could they move to have 40 defenses and put on an expert when clearly he wasn't competent to testify, the trustee's deed wasn't good enough to prove the rest of the case, they didn't prove the deficiency case. And the only way a surety can win is if you say you can foreclose and sue on a guarantee, both. And I don't know where that puts you at the end. It puts you in a real mess. All right. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you all. Again, excellent arguments and briefs, and we appreciate the acceptance in court. And I know the parties are probably aware that we had a number of cases under submission here on the Walters, extension of the Walters issues, and they are pending. We've had other supplemental briefs and all of them. So the court anticipates getting those decisions out in the near future.
I have copies of my PowerPoint. May I lodge them with the court unless there's an objection?
Is there any objection? Okay, you may lodge them with the court clerk Tracy over here.
Short break to allow him to get